This audio fiction is recorded for an adult audience. It may contain scenes of explicit sex, violence, and disturbing supernatural entities. Listener discretion is recommended.
Come, lend me your ear, as I speak to you of the macabre, the cursed, the maligned, the malignant, the possessed, and the downright demonic. Bolt all doors, lock all windows. Are you alone? Are you sure? I suggest you check under the bed, carefully, twice. Did you check deep in the wardrobe, behind the clothes? Are you in bed yet? Did you turn off the lights? They will come soon. They will follow my voice. But it will also keep them at bay, most of them. For some of you, there is no hope. You know who you are. Prepare to be whisked away to lands ancient and modern, familiar and far away. Prepare to question where fiction ends and fact begins. My name is DJ Swales. This is my horror and gothic horror audio fiction podcast. I'm the author of Baratanak, book one in my Fitzmarbury Witches series. The entire novel series came to me in a dream, waking me at 3 a.m. in a small bare writing room I'd rented in Bloomsbury, next door to Bob Marley's old apartment. In 2012, I gave up my London job, home, and mothballed all my worldly belongings to embark on 8 nomadic years of travel, risking everything to chase my dream of becoming a writer. But my dream became an obsession. I wrote 5 million words of prose and hundreds of spontaneous poems in decaying cafes, dusty bookshops, and decrepit hotels. During these 8 years, I journeyed from Istanbul to India, from Beverly Hills to Borneo, from St. Petersburg to Peru, but I published nothing until now. My only constant companion on my exhaustive travels, in countless airports, bus terminals, and railway stations, was a large body-sized suitcase called Letitia. Perhaps it was due to the circumstances of my birth, in the midst of sectarian violence in Northern Ireland, and my own family's trauma, that during my years of transience, I was inexplicably drawn to places with dark histories. Could it be because I've called so many brutally scarred locations home? Like Berlin, Singapore, Nicosia, Manila, Seoul, where my home and art studio burned to the ground, and the high plains of West Texas, where I was left for dead, that I can somehow taste the residual, lingering misery of war, turmoil, and grief. On this dark, blood-sodden earth, I have stood endlessly on the same soil, sand, and stone where many people were extinguished before their time, often in the most grotesque of circumstances, suffering such injustices that their spirits cannot move on. On the wind I heard the moans of trapped souls seeking lost loves. In countless holy places, the prayers of the forgotten faithful still soak every surface and flutter from the walls like the wings of 10,000 moths. My skin prickled as the spirits of the damned crowded closely around me. In my obsessive travels, I ran my hands over the ancient ruins of Baalbek. I stood in the halls of abandoned Armenian monasteries and churches, in the shadow of Mount Ararat. I sought out the greatest of the trees, witnesses to all of man's crimes, placing my hands and ears to their gnarled trunks and gathering their leaves and fallen bark. I followed ghostly footprints in the snow that swirled beneath the cedars of Basho's beloved Koyasan. On the high road to Taos, I heard the ghosts of crying coyotes in an enchanted land once ruled by jaguars. In Goa, stained by the misery of the Inquisition, I dreamt of Nalanda. In Egypt, for so long my second home, I listened to midnight's moonlit silence in the Mamluk mosques of Cairo. I trailed my hands in the waters of the Mother Nile. I watched dust devils dance in the funerary desert temples of dead queens and pharaohs in Thebes. And I descended into the heart of great pyramids, and in tomb robber tunnels, I was surrounded by the bones of noble corpses. I do not doubt that the magic, curses, and broken dreams in each place left an indelible mark on my mind and soul. They have accumulated inside me. Did they infect me or empower me in their yearning to speak of their stories through the dust I inhaled and that still clings to me? But beware, concealed among the dead are other entities. They masquerade as ghosts or lonely spirits, emerging from cracks, crevices, and unholy ruptures. In assorted disguises, they are not as they appear. Pray to your God that they will never reveal their true forms to you. In my journeys, I saw and was seen by many such creatures. They scented the paths I had travelled. I protected myself as best I could with talismans and prayers. I feel some of these spectres pursue me to this day, approaching me in nightmares and oblique shadows. It was only a matter of time before they began to influence my writing. Episode 14 of Baratanak. A Sailor Divulges Desert Secrets. After the 10 holy lots are drawn, the 10 blessed chosen ones are then prepared for the afterlife, the Nubian said to the collected faces around him. As the poor sods are already considered to be half in this world and half in the next, they are stripped naked and painted red and blue, the colour of desert gin. He paused for a moment, gauging the enthusiasm of his audience. They nodded for him to continue, which he did, magnifying his voice by half a whisper. Yes, the colour of gin, and then yellow stripes are traced down their bodies with clay water by... He paused again, this time for effect, and raised an eyebrow. The abbot's own trembling fingers. The men guffawed at this detail before one amongst them hushed their merriment for fear the monks might overhear them. The dirty bastard, the cabin boy hissed. The storyteller was briefly distracted by a riot of Barbary macaques pursued by a huge hairless Hamadryas baboon. The mangy pursuer, who whooped and gambled across the great red-tiled roof of the dock's soaring white marble colonnades, was an individual that terrorized both the native macaques and local people. Both primates were a common enough sight and reminded the man of the pet chimpanzee he had grown up with in his own homeland. As babies, they were traded up through Ethiopia from Azania's inland seas. Seen from above, tree-lined Carthage was an abounding mosaic of white and brilliantly painted flat-topped houses, providing a perfect habitat for the rampant apes. The rich fur and bright eyes of the macaques showed the city varieties to be of a pedigree decidedly healthier than those that made a home in the city dump. Often raiding fine fruit trees in private courtyards, the city primates would fling themselves across narrow alleyways, arms brimming with produce, to bound away over several rooftops in seconds. On broad avenues, the macaque troops could be spotted leaping, one by one, from palm head to palm head. They were just as much at home in the urban warren as the mountain forests, but until the baboons had become established, lived largely without the threat of predators, aside from hungry vagrants who were slow and ungainly dangers. Both baboons and macaques avoided certain booby-trapped orchards from where, once caged, they were shipped to Egypt for mummification. They also steered well clear of the great temple walls, which were patrolled by fanged, beefy mandrill monkeys, the known world's largest, and most proud of their radiant rumps and snouts. Though free of fierce guard mandrills, the stained honeycomb amphitheatre of the malodorous leather tannery was always devoid of wild and feral primates. So steeped in stenches was it that even the paltry faculties of humans found it repugnant. "And so, men," continued the Nubian, "for 10 successive days, each evening of feasting is prescribed around the sacrifice of one of the poor bastards selected to be fed to the crocodiles. And a fine show is prepared for the fat abbots, let me tell you." The sailors looked over at the ascetics, wondering who among them might soon be in the bellies of the immense desert crocodiles. As successively more of the priestess's belongings were borne on board, the Nubian ushered his audience a little further away from the gangway. On his final day of assumption, after being suitably purged, the slender-faced man continued, lowering his voice, "each chosen one is stripped naked, bathed in cleansing argan oil, and furnished sacred herbs to eat." "Sacred herbs!" exclaimed a Sicilian Greek. "They'd have to blow sacred Anatolian opium up my arse, not just some bloody coriander and a brittle sprig of rosemary. Then I'd dance into the pools." He chuckled gleefully, hoisting his hands above his head in a swaying motion. All the men laughed. "Trust a Greek to say that," injected a girthy man from Iberia, casting a suspicious eye at the Greek's large rump. A cloud of ravens circled over the docks, watching the commotion on deck. "Then an innocent bleating lamb is brought to the chosen one," the noble Nubian said, his onlookers still enthralled. "The poor fox that's about to die clutches this other hapless creature to his painted breast. The idea is for its shrieks to goad the hidden monsters that wait nearby in their own shit water." "I feel sorry for the lamb," said one bleary-eyed old sea dog, not the idiot who knew what he was getting himself into, joining the bloody order. "Will you all just shut up and let him finish?" begged a Balearic quartermaster. "For Baal's sake, we've all got jobs to do, and sharpish. We'll get the bloody lash standing around here blethering like a troop of Tingis tanners." "The poor lambs sense what is about to happen," said the Nubian. "They either perceive the bloody ghosts of past lambs all around them, or they detect the lamb's blood in the air and water, borne on the breeze." He swirled his hands about him. "Those that struggle too much have their legs bound with catgut, before the chosen one can finally stride down the sacred rock-lined footpath towards paradise." "Poor fucker," whispered the cabin boy. A few of the sailors were summoned away as the Nubian continued narrating his tale. The 200 live loggerhead turtles, sacks of dried squid, and great barrels of dried and salted strips of fish and meat were not going to carry themselves aboard, nor stack themselves below deck. The dried fish was split evenly between sardine and tuna, the latter gaffed and hauled aboard low boats among the giant, densely converged breeding shoals in the Bay of Tripoli. So numerous were they there that fishermen were said to tread across their backs, although the prolific numbers of sharks that trailed them meant this daring act could mean dancing into the jaws of death. Dozens of times the great predators had breached from beneath in a great fountain of spray, their jaws closing around men's torsos before hauling them down to the deep. Officers' rations also included portions of salted mountain pork, pickled venison, dried goat meat, and the spiced marinated loins of surplus young male elephants harvested from the Carthage armories. The consumption of the turtles was always saved for last, as they could survive below deck for months. Their blood and piss were precious as emergency ambrosia. Not only had a large storeroom been converted to accommodate the priestess and her belongings, but a further 3 smaller storerooms in the low passageway leading to it were sealed and declared off-limits. Instead, the fresh and pickled fruit, seeds and vegetables had been crammed onto other galleys, much to the chagrin of the portly cook, who also had to suspend his spices outside portals in roped jars. As he did so, 3 huge sea wolves that had glided into the harbour gathered and watched with interest from below. When some Sebek ascetics passed closer to the group of tattling sailors, the Nubian grabbed the cabin boy's reed hat. He deposited it upon his own head, tilting the brim of it down over his face, then pushing it up with his thumb when they had passed. Tall, carved wooden poles along the chosen one's path to the holy pools are carved on their reverse with hideous demon faces, he said. Only if the monk glances back over his shoulder will he see them. Their purpose is to frighten him out of returning. More frightening than an enormous fucking crocodile that's waiting for him at the end of the path? Asked the large-bottomed Greek. You have not seen those carvings, said the Nubian. Well, neither have you, retorted the Greek. The Nubian pondered this for a second, drafting his response. Well, I have it from a good source, he answered. These carvings appear in the night and are not the work of human hands. And around them the totems are festooned with black ribbons that flutter and twist furiously in the hot evening wind. Airs summoned by djinn that without fail career across the desert sands just before sundown, from dunes and mountains to barrel through the courtyards and halls. The whistle of that wind is heard in even the deepest inner sanctum. Finally, with incense upon its breath, it ripples the greasy surfaces concealing the ancient scaled children of Sebek. At times these ribbons dance willfully, obscuring the path ahead from the chosen one, requiring him to pause. He stared about him, drilling his eyes into those of the men. But there is no going back from the painted tiles, and no fear is to be shown. No fear, said the Greek Sicilian with a laugh. I could follow my own trail of shit back up that path until I was safe in the foul abbot's bed. I'd suck cock in hell for eternity rather than face such a paradise. I'd take death by crocodile myself, said the sleepy-eyed sea dog with a grin, despite having spent a few lonely nights between the legs of several crewmen. Well, what if I told you that return for these poor men is not an option? Neither warming the abbot's feet in bed, nor an eternity sucking his limp cockers either, said the Nubian leaning towards them. You see, upon a nearby tower, an archer keeps a keen eye and a taut arrow in case a change of heart flickers across the countenance of the chosen one. The sailors gasped at this. The dirty, rotten cocksuckers, came a young voice from the back of the bunch. The cabin boy looked like his eyes might pop out. There have been monks in the past, said the Nubian, from whom arrows glanced harmlessly when they ventured to retreat from fate. After a relentless whipping by crocodile leather, some of the lucky ones would be bound and buried alive in the sands. But for most, suffocating sandy dungeons awaited their lacerated, bleeding bodies. And then thirst and slow starvation, to be eaten alive by maggots and beetles in their wounds once their arms were too weakened to pick them off. Soon enough, Just another still, silent corpse piled on old skeletons, paradise denied. Dungeons, are you sure? More like chained up in a secret sex chamber next to that fat abbot's bedroom, said the Berber. Poor bastard, said the cabin boy, peering at some of the silent monks amassed on the docks. I wonder why they ever join in the first place. Some are bartered by their families, spat the Nubian without hesitation, by heartless fathers and shameless mothers. There, even on the holy blessed shores of Lake Nubia, where such prospects should not even be myth, others are abducted as young children, especially those born on holy days of Sebek. They are there 1 minute, then gone, vanish beneath the long cloaks of passing strangers, sold to agents or conveyed to the temple gates in exchange for holy intercession. Other arrivals are the illegitimate children of the abbots, sired with whores and dragged to the monasteries to be raised firstly as slaves under the secrecy of their paternal gaze. Their origin becomes evident when after 20 years their names have never been suggested for the sacrificial draw. Go on, urged the cabin boy, the arms of the Sicilian around his shoulders. What happens next? The sacrifice. Should I continue? Asked the Nubian. Yes, they all exclaimed in unison. Well then, I will. So you are better informed of these monks that you see around you. The largest of Sebek's vile progeny that are still slumbering, which they may pretend to do for weeks at a time, are roused and provoked for the sacrifice. Feigning sloth, they await any complacency from their anointed attendants. From sunup, they have anticipated the day's proceedings. The Nubian leaned in even closer to the men, bending his knees to crouch as he whispered the innermost secrets from those desert cloisters. From muddied waters, dozens of cold, compassionless eyes watch the advance of the Chosen One. Eyes and pointed nostrils alone break the surface, their reptilian senses frustrated at times by the billowing black ribbons. Desert dust storms may also bedim the air, as here and there a slice of coiled, winding spine cuts through the water, betraying cruel impatience, but it will not be long. Down the sacred path approaches the Chosen One, taking the slightest steps, prolonging his last quiet moments before an unfathomable violence will make every nerve scream. When he finally reaches the sacred ship water's edge, the poor bleating lamb still scuffling in his arms, the Chosen One addresses all those assembled. In words long repeated and long practiced, the poor fuck exclaims, "For all the unworthy among you, it is right that you envy me." The Nubian gesticulated grandly, though still kept his voice low. "Know that though it is I who am most blessed," he says, tears of fear streaming down his face and snot bubbling from his nose, "one day you may also join me in paradise. Serve Sebek and his holy fathers well, and do not falter in his fearful shadow." Then the monk casts his eye over all the fat, corrupt perverts lining the balconies and walkways around the holy pool, who sit there resplendent in silks, wine in hand, and delicacies smeared across their lips. Twice he calls to them, "There is only one true faith." In response, the senior clergy and all the assembled monks repeat those words back in kind. Then a third repetition, but this time only from the most senior abbot and his favourites, as they cry in unison, "There is only one true faith." "Those cowards feast and play footsie while that poor bastard is about to be eaten," said an Egyptian. "It sounds familiar, doesn't it, lads? Like the great and the good of Carthage, so many of whom now bring secretly adopted children to burn rather than their own blood." He scorned the religious practices of his adopted city. "Be careful, Egyptian, that's blasphemy," hissed the cabin boy. The Nubian sensed discord and clicked his fingers to draw them back. "The climax awaits, men," he promised, a glint in his eye. As he spoke, the shadow of a large vulture passed over him. Several were circling the docks. The abbot then stands and announces some bullshit about how the high clergy wished that they could be the ones entering into the jaws of Sebek that evening. Then, with his spindly fingers, he takes a yellow sash from across his shoulders, casting it from the edge of the balcony down to the pools below. This is the token for the chosen one to fulfill his destiny. At this point, the poor lamb's bleating has served to pull cold, reptilian blood through veins like thunder. The calm surface of the water belies the beasts below, sprung like traps to erupt in slaughter. As the poor sod's toes break the oil-slicked surface, ripples vibrate through the waters. In their anticipation, some of Sebek's children rise in force against each other. Where they breach, terrible tumults of water fly high. Lines of sharp-toothed jaws and tree-trunk-sized tails reveal themselves to the horrified monk. The lamb screams. "Holy shit!" stammered the fat-bottomed Greek, clenching his buttocks, each cheek of which could have sated a black-eyed giant of Sebek. First one step, then another. Now the chosen one is knee-deep, now waist. The rooftop archer sets down his bow. Contact is imminent. The Nubian is breathless now. Oh, men, the huge bodies of 20 unseen gods are now gliding towards man and lamb, betrayed by thin lines of scales and upwellings of muddy water. It will not take long. Having been expertly starved for a month, to the cusp of attacking each other, during these 10 days of festivities, they will fight over every morsel of human flesh from those poor 10 monks, their only desire being to tear meat from sinew and sinew from bone. It is said that the forces are so great from the first to the subsequent strikes that often the chosen one is torn asunder between several hook-toothed jaws without a chance to cry for final blessings. The lamb melts to nothing in the froth, its last bleat drowned in its own blood. Having concluded his detailed account, the Nubian cast his eyes to the skies, lingering on the broad-winged silhouettes that circled. He prayed they would soon depart, so as not to bring bad omens upon them. As his face strained to the sun, he rubbed a black tattoo of Anubis on his wrist, concealing where a crocodile had once curled. As the men went back to their tasks, he reminded them that should they ever seek hospitality at an oasis where dwelled the followers of Sebek and his children, then they had best sleep with one eye open. But it was for naught. Their fates lay across deserts of water, not sand. Thank you for listening. If you have enjoyed this episode, then please subscribe. I must leave you now, but do not despair. If you listen to the next installment, the curse cannot harm you, but you must believe. Now pull the blanket over your head and be quiet. You are not alone. Shh.